project permitted, and I, in all candor, would have to say it's a little bit of a really know how these standards are going to be applied to this type of development. And that's a tough position for somebody that wants to invest money in a state to be in, to have somebody tell them, I really can't tell you ahead of time whether or not you're likely to get a permit. So the Wind Power Task Force met and did its work, and I was on the task force, and I will say just from my perspective, I think, you know, part of the impetus was how do we identify a process that makes sense? How do we provide greater regulatory clarity and certainty so that somebody coming into the process knows what the rules of the road are and can say, as long as I know what the requirements are, I can make a decision whether or not I think I have a project that will meet those requirements and can make an informed decision of whether or not to invest and you know, and begin that multi-year process of preparing an application. I think one thing it's important for people to remember that, you know, it's a multi-year process before you even submit an application for review, because you do you collect MET data, you do bird and bat studies, you do environmental surveys. So it really is, there's a lot of work that occurs before a project is even presented to an agency for consideration.
Representative Duncan.
I have a question, if I may.
Yes.
Can you, you were involved in writing some of these laws, some of the expedited wind laws? Or you were on the task force?
Yeah, I was on the task force.
Okay. Can you tell me how much field work was done to assure that the laws that were written wouldn't have a detrimental effect on Maine's people or place? What criteria did you look at?
Well,
and how much field work was done?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not aware of specific field work that the task force went out and did. I think what they did was they had input from many different entities and environmental groups, agencies. You know, the task force included representatives from Department of Conservation, DEP, LURC, Maine Audubon participated, CLF, NRCM. So I think, and then Alec Giffen, of course, you know, had vast knowledge of particularly LURC jurisdiction. So I think he drew on that information as well. But I think, you know, from where I sat, it was more of a process of soliciting information from agencies and entities with knowledge as opposed to going out and independently gathering that data.
So no one really went out and gathered data from your task force?
No, we gathered quite a lot of information and data from other entities with the expertise, from Department of Conservation, from Bureau of Parks and Lands, from DEP, and from LURC. But we, I mean, we actually went on site visits to wind projects, but we certainly weren't going out and walking the terrain ourselves.
May I follow up? I sort of get the feeling that let me do this as a question. did you take a look at whether wind power was truly good and appropriate for Maine? Or did you just make the assumption that it was and then design your laws and siting around that assumption?
You know, that's a great question. One of the challenges in the permitting of the early LURC projects was there was substantial testimony and time devoted to talking about the energy impacts and of wind power and complicated issues about the grid and what impact on race was wind power going to have, just a number of issues that, quite frankly, the PUC maybe had the expertise to address, but certainly a citizen board like LURC didn't really have the expertise to address. And one of the things the committee did was, in fact, the task force, was look at the act, you know, is wind power beneficial to the state of Maine, and did look at that information. So I don't think it was necessarily assumed by everybody, but certainly as a result of that process, that was the conclusion, is that, yes, wind power is something beneficial that we want to encourage in appropriate locations. I mean, I think everybody acknowledged wind power is not appropriate everywhere, but how do we identify where it's appropriate and then identify standards and criteria to facilitate development in those areas.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that the assumption is that it is good anywhere as long as it's in the UTs, where there's truly no input from the citizens in the UTs. So they've sort of been excluded from the process, if you will. And it seems to me that as long as the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, that I mean, just as an example, and perhaps you can give me some feedback on this as well, is Connecticut has already decided they want to get their energy from a wind development in Maine that hasn't even been approved yet. So it seems to me that the assumption is that, yeah, if you jump through a few hoops, that it's going to happen regardless of what the people want. Can you comment on that? Or would you be willing to comment on that?
Sure, I'm happy to. So first of all, the only portions of the unorganized territories are included in the so-called expedited wind permitting area. So it's not even the majority of the unorganized jurisdiction. So it is specific areas of the unorganized jurisdiction. And one of the things that was important that came out during the discussions in the task force was that the sort of remote core of the jurisdiction, which is sort of the jewel of the jurisdiction, was not included in the expedited permitting area. And that was intentional. So the areas that were included in the expedited permitting area were generally closer to existing infrastructure, closer to townships, and had those types of attributes. So it's certainly not the case that every or even the majority of the area of the unorganized jurisdiction is included in this area that was determined to be most appropriate for wind power development. With respect to the notion that as long as you jump through the right hoops, you come out at the end of the day with a permit, I can tell you, having represented First Wind on the Bowers project, that's not the case. And I'm sure that the Passadumkeag developers could tell you that wasn't the case, having gone through the DEP process. But one thing that's really important to keep in mind is that, you know, a developer doesn't want to invest several million dollars in a project that doesn't meet the regulatory review criteria. So there's a sort of process that occurs early on to eliminate projects that are not going to meet the review criteria. So by the time a developer submits an application, that developer has done his or her legwork and believes that the project meets the review criteria. And I think the idea is, let's have clarity and certainty in the review criteria so that a developer knows ahead of time, so they don't submit that project that's not going to get a permit. And the process at LURC and at DEP has been incredibly robust. The agencies have taken a hard look at projects. They've imposed pretty significant requirements on wind power projects that have not been imposed on other types of development. So, I can tell you certainly from where I sit, it's not a done deal that when you enter the process, you come out with a permit. And certainly the idea behind the Wind Energy Act was, let's at least try to provide greater clarity to developers so that they know what they need to do, so that they can come out at the other end with a permit.
Follow-up question?
Yes, sir. And in the UTs in the expedited area, how was it determined who would be expedited and who would not be? And again, was public? I mean, there are a lot of people that live in the UTs, at least in my neck of the woods. And how was there any input from the citizens living there, or was this done? I mean, I know it was done behind closed doors. I've seen some of the reports, but did you actually go out and talk to citizens? Were any comments solicited, and how did this expedited area get selected?
There was a process of a series of public meetings at which the public was invited to. The task force heard from members of the public, including from people in the unorganized jurisdiction, and as I said, solicited input from DEP, from LURC, from the Department of Conservation, from organizations that have a great interest in the unorganized area, including organizations like NRCM. So, I mean, I think there was substantial input. There wasn't a sort of separate public hearing process in the unorganized territory as part of this. It was all done as part of a series of public meetings that the task force held. And then of course, it went to the legislature, and the committee held public hearings, and there was that whole process before the act was actually adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Youngblood. Thank you. Obviously, in something that's as a big a public policy direction as this was, there's lots of discussion, lots of input, lots of data collected from a whole group of different entities that ultimately gets funneled down to the people. As a Monday morning quarterback, what kind of things have you found that were a surprise to you that weren't considered or whatever? It would seem to me that, in, from the projects I've been involved with, that when it's over and done with, you look back and you say, God, we didn't expect that. We didn't expect that. Any surprises that come to mind that from this process, now that we've done some of these projects?
I don't know if it's a surprise as much as really just a comment that we obviously are still struggling with how you evaluate scenic impacts. And you know, one of the reasons for the task force work was to reduce controversy over siting of wind projects. And the whole process was designed really to address siting controversies. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that there still remains controversy over the siting objects. I think, you know, some of the public polling data that was recently released shows there's still overwhelming support for wind power in the state. But there's obviously a vocal group of people that are opposed to wind power, both as a policy matter and specific projects. And, you know, I don't think you can eliminate controversy over projects. I guess I would have hoped we could have had more clarity and certainty for the regulated community as a result of the Wind Energy Act, but I think it remains a work in progress.
Okay. Representative Neuendijk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In a number of our emails that we've received, people complain about the loss in the value of their property. Was that considered amongst your initial considerations, whether or not people's property values would be impacted?
You guys are really going to task my memory here. I thought I was just talking about the permitting process. Don't hold me to this. I believe it was discussed. I think that maybe Stacy Fitz has a better memory than I do. I think it was, but I candidly would have to go back and look at some of the specifics. I think that Orlando DeLogue provided a series of papers on the economic impact. I can't remember if it went into any of the potential impacts on property values.
Well, since we lack institutional memory, being turned over, we're depending on others for their institutional memory. And Mr. Fitz, I'm sure, will help us out in that regard.
Just one very quick question.
You mentioned that this is a work in progress. So you would be supportive of looking at the OIS report and making the modifications that's recommended in that report?
I'm not sure I would agree with all the modifications recommended in that report, and I confess I haven't looked at that report in some time. I'd have to go back and look at it. But I think any kind of major policy initiative, it's always appropriate to continue to look at it and see if it needs tweaks. My suggested modifications might be quite different than other modifications suggested by other people. But, I mean, I think, for example, you know, there was a change in the tangible benefits requirement that I think was quite specific. To ensure that host communities received a very specific, concrete, identifiable benefit.